Morning, Council.
I'm Bill Livingston. I represent the petitioner Mukhtar Al-Warafi. When this case was first heard by Judge Lamberth in January 2010, it was our position that Mukhtar was a civilian medical worker working in civilian clinics for a civilian doctor. Judge Lamberth agreed that Mukhtar was a medical worker and working in clinics, but said that when he worked in the clinics, he was working, quote, as needed, on an as-needed basis within the command structure of the Taliban, close quote. And because he was within the command structure of the Taliban, Judge Lamberth concluded that he was part of the Taliban.
That's been affirmed, hasn't it?
And that has been affirmed by the
first
panel.
He is part of the Taliban.
That has been affirmed.
That's the law of the case.
Right. The judge did not consider, we said, well, if he's part of the Taliban, then he's entitled to the protections that the Geneva Convention provides for medical workers.
And Judge Lambert, the prior panel of this court said there was not an adequate record on that question and sent it back for redecision.
Not an adequate.
That's all that's before us today, right?
Right. The panel
said,
the panel said that's right, that we can't tell from his decision whether when he said as needed, he meant that Mukhtar was just an auxiliary medical worker who could be detained, or whether whether he was a full-time medical worker. And so there was a remand. The government argued in that first appeal that the as-needed language in the first opinion by Judge Lamberth meant that he was, necessarily meant that he was an auxiliary medical worker. And that argument was rejected by the Court
right.
of Appeals.
Fine.
They make the same argument.
Can you get to this case?
Right. Well, they make the same argument on this appeal.
It's not the same record.
But they don't have the same record. The judge did not repeat the as-needed finding. So that issue is out of the case. Now, what the district court held was that after reciting the work that Mukhtar did in the clinic for Dr. Aziz and all of his medical work and work in a hospital,
he said he didn't have an identifying insignia and he didn't have a card.
Didn't have a card or an arm.
And you're claiming that he did, that the judge should have held him to be a medic subject to the protection of the medic provisions anyway.
Right.
And the government's arguing, no, if he's entitled to rights under the protection under the convention, he has to be in compliance with the convention.
Right.
Is that not the issue?
I don't think that completely is an accurate statement, because the government doesn't defend nor did it argue below for what Judge Lamberth held. Judge Lamberth's holding that an ID card and an armband were necessary, which he based on Article 40 of the convention, it was not an argument that the government made below or that it makes here. And respectfully, Judge Lamberth should be reversed. The first panel in this case knew that there was no armband and no ID card. It said in its two-page opinion, it specifically said, he did not have an armband or an ID card, and it cited, the panel cited Article 40. And it said, as a result of this, we believe that Mukhtar may bear the burden of proof, or it seems like he has the burden of proof. But if the absence of an armband or the absence of an ID card by itself disposes of Article 24 protections, as Judge Lamberth has held, then there would have been no need for the remand. The panel knew of that, that there was no ID. So that issue has been decided. It was not open to Judge Lamberth to say, no, the absence of an ID card means more than shifting the burden of proof. It means that you're out of court altogether. So we think that issue has already been decided. In addition, Article 24 by its terms doesn't require that you have an ID card to have protections or an armband. It says you're protected if you're exclusively engaged in medical work. And there's nothing in the commentaries.
Under the convention, how is the detaining nation to know that a person's entitled to the status of medic without the ID card and the insignia?
The convention doesn't, I don't think there are provisions in the convention that speak to that. Obviously that is.
Unless those provisions.
But of course you could even have an armband and not be qualified to wear one.
Certainly would shift the inquiry though if you had the insignia of the medic and there were not evidence that you were shooting at somebody.
Right.
It would make it a different case.
And that's one of the purposes, is to help in the sorting out process. But here, the sorting out process has occurred. The judge has found that he was a medic. So there's no, that's not in dispute.
He found that he rendered some services of a medic. He never found he was a full-time medic, did he?
Well, he found that he was a medic working in clinics and working in a hospital, that he worked with Dr. Aziz. The evidence supports that. His own statement that he was working full-time. The statement of the screening form when he first came into American custody says he is an assistant to a primary care physician. He was captured at a hospital. All of the evidence points to him being full-time. There's no contrary evidence. There's no argument by the government that he wasn't. There's no statement by the district court that he wasn't. The district court characterizes him as a medic, and that's what he was. And as a consequence, because he was an exclusively engaged medical worker, he's entitled to protection. And the commentaries to the convention make it clear that although the cards and the armbands play a role, the armband in particular during combat protects you from being shot. It gives your opponents knowledge that you're a protected individual. But it's the commentaries say that from the moment that a medical personnel has been identified, shortcomings in the means of identification cannot be used as a pretext for failing to respect him. And that's at the comment page 225 of the protocol commentaries. And the commentaries say that the ID does not constitute the right to protection. I think it's also noteworthy here that the government does not defend, nor did it argue below, in favor of what Judge Lamberth held. The government has not taken...
We have a combination of facts here, though, the no armband, no ID card. Taliban doesn't have a medical corps, hasn't designated a permanent and exclusive medic here. So you have a combination of factors, maybe any one or two of them. You'd have to analyze whether they were sufficient, but all of them put together, is that not good enough?
I think the better way to characterize their argument and the way they phrase it is the problem here is that the Taliban did not have a dedicated or established medical corps, as they call it, and the Taliban did not have a practice of designating medical personnel with, as they say, within the meaning of Article 24, whatever they may mean by that. So it's a shortcoming of the Taliban.
I don't know what they meant by that.
I don't know what they meant by that, but I do know that the implication is that nobody in the Taliban would be entitled to Article 24 protection because there's no established medical corps.
Right.
All the permanent medical workers, doesn't make any difference on their theory. Everybody in Afghanistan.
Well, if there are any. But see, when they don't have such a corps, it doesn't follow that there are any to be deprived of this protection.
Well,
it's perfectly possible that no one's entitled to that protection, counsel.
That's certainly their argument. But
it's certainly possible, isn't it, counsel?
I suppose you could have an enemy who had no medical workers and no medical services.
No dedicated medical corps, and that seems to be the holding here.
No, it's not the holding, and it's not. There's nothing in the convention or in the convention commentaries that requires a so-called dedicated medical corps. I'm sure the Taliban didn't have a medical corps that looked at anything like what the United States has, but there are many signatories to the Geneva Convention who are protected by Article 24, third world countries, people who are in insurrectionists in Libya, maybe the Northern Alliance in this very case. Are their doctors, their nurses not protected? Of course they're protected. And there's no requirement.
Well, how do we know they are?
Well, there's
they've
no...
got doctors out there, and I think Northern Alliance has been accused of it. Doctors out there wielding weapons, or medics out there wielding weapons, they're not protected, are they?
No, if you wield a weapon, if you commit hostile acts, that's clear that you're not entitled to protection. But if you're exclusively engaged, the requirement of Article 24 is you are exclusively engaged in medical work, no hostile acts. That's the only requirement. There's nothing in the commentaries that says you lose that protection because your force doesn't have a so-called dedicated medical corps.
But if you add on top of that, so we don't necessarily have to go that far, right? Because you add on top of that the specific facts of this case, which are no armband, no ID, on top of the Taliban not having a dedicated force and a practice of designating. You put all that together, that's a stronger case than just the mere fact that the Taliban doesn't have an established medical corps, right?
It's not a case because Article 24 does not put those conditions on protections. But beyond that, more importantly, I don't at all accept the premise that there was no designation here. The ruling by the district court was that Mukhtar worked in the clinic within the command structure, and the district court specifically found in his first petition, in first opinion, that he was not working, quote, on his own volition, free from Taliban command, close quote. And the court went on to say he was transferred from one clinic to another by the Taliban and surrendered on orders of the Taliban. And as such, he was doing what they directed him to do. That's what the judge held. If he hadn't been doing what they directed him to do, what they designated him to do, he would have been a civilian, as we argued, and he'd be free on that basis. But once you accept the proposition that he was working at the clinics at the direction of the Taliban, then he was designated. So this notion they have that he wasn't designated to work as a medical worker full-time, he was so designated, and the judge found that he wasn't working in these clinics on his own volition, free from Taliban command. And did the Taliban have a medical service? Well, they didn't have a medical service, or medical services in Afghanistan at the time were primitive. There's evidence in the record on that. But there were medical services, and the Taliban provided them. Mukhtar, if you accept the judge's opinion, is a living example of medical service provided by the Taliban. He is a Taliban person, according to the judge, operating within the command structure, whose job it is to work in a clinic and to work in a hospital and provide medical services, assisting a doctor. That's medical service. Now, is that an established medical service? Of course it's established. Is it formalistic like the United States Medical Corps? No. But there's nothing in the convention that says you have to have a medical corps that looks like the one that the United States has. If you have medical services and you have workers in the services who are full-time, who are not engaged in hostile acts, then they are entitled to protection under the Geneva Convention, under Article 24.
Is this a matter of whose burden this is?
I don't think the burden...
You can't just... I don't think you can seriously contend that they get there and because somebody's in a hospital, they can't detain him. So you're not contending that, are you?
Detaining what?
The U.S. forces get there. There is a person in a hospital.
Right.
You're not saying they can't detain him just if he says, I'm here at the hospital and I'm a medic.
Oh, medics and doctors can be detained under the Geneva Convention. Yep. And it was common in prior wars where entire armies would surrender or battalions. Right. And everybody, the cooks, the bottle washers,
right.
medics.
That's not getting us far in this case, counsel.
Right. So there's a sorting out process.
Why are you turning loose now?
Because there's been a finding that he worked as a medic. All of the evidence supports that. There is no evidence.
But
not
suppose he works as a medic, but he's also available to be a driver for combat missions.
Well,
he could be, detention could continue. Don't tell me what happened in other wars. Detention could continue in that circumstance, could it not?
No.
Could not? If he were a part-time medic and he were also available for support services in a combat mission?
Well, that's not the issue. Is he a full-time medic? Are full-time medics?
That's exactly where I'm trying to take you.
And full-time
somebody has the burden on the question of whether he's a full-time medic.
Well, the evidence here is that he was full-time, and I think the district court's findings, fairly read, are that he was full-time. That was the question the judge was asked to answer. This is an experienced district judge. He said he was a medic. He said that was the issue he was to address. But getting to your question about being available for combat, medics...
Get to my question about the burden. Whose burden is it to establish that he is or is not a full-time medic?
The district court said it was ours and said it didn't make any difference.
It has to be yours, doesn't it?
No, I don't think it has to be. I think the burden should be on
the
government.
Otherwise, if they come in, as I'm describing, the U.S. troops come in, and seizing people for detention, you would be saying they have to release anybody who says, I'm a full-time medic.
No, I don't say that. The question is, what does the evidence show? And we've had a hearing in this case.
What does the evidence show given whose burden?
That's right. And the judge put the burden on us and still found that he was a medic. So we have the findings.
Are you contending that you don't have the burden?
We have contended that in this case, and our arguments have not been accepted. I think we win whether we have it or not. I don't think it's an important issue. I agree with Judge Lambert that the burden issue is academic, since he has found that my client was a medic, and all the evidence is that he was a medic. But on this combat issue, I think this is an important issue because they make a big deal of he being available for combat. Medics, ambulance drivers, cooks in a hospital, orderlies in a hospital, they're all entitled to Article 24 protection if they are full-time medical workers. They are all also subject to being told by their commanding officers, we need infantry men.
And
we're going to put you in the line.
We've gotten past your time limit now, so we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
If I could just say one more thing on that.
No, your time is up.
Okay, thank you.
Unless my colleagues have further questions. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Lowell Sturgill from the Department of Justice representing the government. Under Article 24, permanent and exclusive medics are given a special status, and they are entitled to special privileges, including limitations on the right to retain them during while the conflict is still ongoing. The quid pro quo for that special treatment, that special treatment they're given, the convention makes clear in the commentary, is that they are designated by their military force to be a permanent and exclusive medic and trained in the responsibilities that special status involves. And that is a responsibility not to engage in offensive, hostile acts against the military.
So can the Taliban have any medics that qualify under your theory of the case?
Well, on this record, the answer is no, because as you have discussed already, the district court made a factual finding that Taliban forces did not have a practice of designating anybody as a full-time, permanent, and exclusive medic. That factual finding is entitled to clear error review, and there's no evidence in this record that would justify overturning that factual finding. Given that finding, the answer to your question on this record is no.
What about even without a formal designation, if all the evidence made it obvious, certain, that someone was exclusively a doctor?
Well, that is a question we've suggested you don't have to answer in this case, and it's better for you not to answer. It's better to take this sensitive area of the law on a fact-specific, narrow kind of basis in your ruling.
Your position's not all that narrow.
Well, if you look at what the district...
Your position is that, I mean, although you have underscored on this record, the record's going to be the same in all the Taliban cases, presumably, on this point. But
I have no reason to believe otherwise. That's
right.
Correct.
So your position essentially is that the Taliban can't have established medics. And I don't know that we need to go that far to resolve this case because we have no armband, no ID card, the lack of a practice. We have a multitude of factors here that all... point in that direction.
Well, that's right. We think you should consider all the evidence of the record.
I appreciate the narrow term. I'm not, I think there's a narrower way.
I agree. The narrowest possible ground is what the district court said, and that's that the petitioner has no evidence, right, that he was designated as an Article 24 permanent and exclusive medic and that he was trained in the special.
The district court said, plus what you're saying here combined is even more narrow.
I accept that as well. The government on remand also submitted evidence with respect to what the United States' own practice is in terms of understanding and implementing Article 24. And the United States' practice is that we do designate individuals as permanent and exclusive Article 24 medics and provide them the training in what their responsibilities are that the convention and the commentaries refer to. The commentaries make it very clear that it's the responsibility of the military service to provide this kind of understanding, and to the word they use is debar. They're supposed to debar these individuals from engaging in offensive, hostile acts. That's straight out of the commentary. And the commentary also explains that these individuals have a special status. They're viewed as non-combatants. They're above and beyond the conflict. They have a quasi-neutral character. And what we have here, again, on the record, is we have, based on the factual findings have already been affirmed, we have an individual who went to Afghanistan to fight. He received weapons training on an AK-47 at the front lines. He was assigned to a military fighting unit. He was then, after his medic status, picked up with the weapon, along with 400 other Taliban fighters. And he surrendered pursuant to a surrender agreement that was negotiated by his Taliban commander. And in light of all this, the notion that he was a quasi-neutral above and beyond the conflict at any stage really just flies in the face of everything that's in the record. And all you have that opposes that is his own declaration. But again, his own declaration, if you read it closely, he doesn't say that Taliban forces ever designated him to be a permanent and exclusive medic. He never says that he was provided any of this training or instruction that we know from the record that they actually didn't provide to anybody. So even if you look at his own declarations, he doesn't make the proof, advance the proof that he needs to. I think that's all you really need to have to decide in this case in order to affirm the district court's judgment. And his whole view, he just told you what his view is. His view is that evidence that he worked as a medic is sufficient to prove his Article 24 status. Well, that can't be right. That's the same argument that the district court rejected. He argued of this functional analysis, that you look at what he's doing when he's picked up. Well, again, that's not right. For one thing, it completely obliterates the difference between Article 24, permanent and exclusive medics, and Article 25, as-needed medics. In the field, you can have Article 24, permanent exclusive medics, and Article 25, temporary medics, working side by side at any particular time. If they're all picked up, the party has to have a way to distinguish between the two. And looking at what they were doing when they were picked up doesn't provide that kind of distinction. What provides it is, again, this evidence in some form, preferably the special identity card, that they were designated by their force as a permanent and exclusive Article 23 medic, and understand what their limited position was. That's basically, I think, all you need to decide, but yes.
My question is whether you can ever translate this these provisions, which clearly are designed for traditional powers who have organized militaries, to this kind of non-traditional fighting force that you have in the Taliban. Can you even apply this to them?
Well, our position in this case has been that even if you take Article 24 verbatim and assume that it applies to this case, our office cannot make out that kind of proof, and the district court's findings should be affirmed, so that you shouldn't really... I'm sorry.
That wasn't the question that we just put, though, was it?
Well,
That's an answer to a question, but not her question.
It's a roundabout way of saying that we've asked the court not to address your question. And I would note that that's why we're here today, because the first D.C. Circuit panel basically assumed, for the sake of argument, that Article 24...
The application of the conventions to asymmetric war is a very difficult area of inquiry in general, is it not?
And one that we think the court is better off not wading into in this kind of a case.
After the NDAA, isn't it clear now that the law of war, the international law of war, doesn't just inform the detention authority, as you put in the briefs, but it actually constrains the detention authority now? In other words, the NDAA changes, potentially, whether it's a change or not, it makes clear that the international law of war is now judicially enforceable constraint on the government's detention authority. Do you agree with that?
I think that's another question you should not address in this case.
If we get your agreement to that, it makes Judge Brown's question a rather interesting one, doesn't it?
Well, again, it's
pretty clear on the face of the statute that whatever was going on before, the international law of war is now not just informing the government's detention authority, it's constraining it, and it's constraining it in a judicially enforceable way that we will have to independently interpret the international law and enforce it against you, even if you disagree about the meaning of that said international law.
Again, Your Honor, I believe that's a question you shouldn't reach, don't need to reach, and because, again, our position is if...
On it, though? Even though I know you don't
we haven't reach taken,
it, you haven't taken a position. The NDAA seems pretty clear in its face. We'll just point that out to you.
If we don't decide it here, we have to decide it in some other cases, don't we?
Well, I would note that the issue hasn't been briefed.
And I guess we don't have to decide
by district court. I think you'd be much better off waiting for a case in which it had been fully briefed by the parties.
Not sure what you would say in the face of that pretty clear language, which obviously Congress put that in there after the issue had been flagged. I don't know if it's in response to, but in Al-Mahani and other cases that clarify what Congress's intent. And Congress did not put it in for other wartime authorities, but for detention authority, it's now specifically clear that the law of war is not just informing, which is a word I think we've discussed before, but constraining.
Well, one potential thought or response without taking a position is that my understanding is that the statute, the NDAA, affirms basically the government's understanding of how the AOF was applying. And of course, the government's understanding.
Whether it was intended to or not, it may, in the plain text of it, constrain the government's authority more than the government's authority might have been constrained beforehand.
At least for
judicial purposes.
I think I understand your question, but again, it's one that we haven't taken a position on, and we would ask you not to in this case.
You're not authorized to give us an answer, would be perhaps what you're thinking of saying.
At the risk of discussing things that I think you shouldn't have, other things that I think you shouldn't address, on this alternative question.
I wouldn't have brought it up if you didn't have the word informed in the brief. The word informed in the brief followed by a cite to the NDAA, which raised the question.
Then perhaps on this other point I was going to make, we have in our brief explained our view of what the prior panel's determination about the as-needed finding means and doesn't mean, and I would just refer you to that to the extent he discussed that this morning. Other than that, we would ask the court to affirm.
Okay, unless my colleagues have questions, then we'll give 2 minutes back to the petitioner for rebuttal.
This was not an asymmetric war. Taliban was the government of Afghanistan. Afghanistan was a signatory of the Geneva Convention. It was entitled to the protections of those conventions. It had.
Given that it was not asymmetric war, then it was reasonable to expect that if they wanted the protection, then they could have had a dedicated medic corps, wouldn't it?
There's nothing in the convention or in the commentaries that says that that's required.
Nobody suggested
nothing.
It was required.
The convention says.
Somebody has a burden here, and the evidence on that burden would be the sort of thing is, was he in a dedicated corps? Did he have a card? Did he have an armband?
The question is, under Article 24, is, was he medical personnel exclusively engaged in the treatment of the sick and wounded?
One might expect that he just couldn't claim that without evidence, mightn't one? Might expect that there would be an evidentiary question for the courts.
And the court had hearings. There was evidence. There's a lot of evidence. And there's no contrary evidence. The evidence is, and the finding is, he's a medic.
How about the evidence that there is no such dedicated corps? How about the evidence that he had no armband? How about the evidence that he had no ID card?
He had no armband. He had no card.
Right. So your statement that there's no contrary evidence is just not accurate, is it?
There's no contrary evidence as to what he was doing day to day. He was treating the sick and wounded. That's all that Article 24 requires.
No, it requires he be doing that exclusively.
It says he would be exclusively engaged in the treatment of the sick or wounded, and that's what the record shows, and that's what the court's findings were. There's nothing in the conventions that say you have to have a dedicated or established medical corps. The government's just making that up. That's not in the case. I agree on the NDAA point. I would like to say, before I close, something about my client, who's been in jail now for more than 10 years and is now in jail because he didn't have a piece of paper in his pocket and some cloth on his arm. He was described in the first opinion as a low-level Taliban member, not Al-Qaeda. There's never been a claim that he had anything to do with Al-Qaeda. This is a Taliban-only case at a time when Taliban was the government.
I misspoke when I characterized it as an asymmetric war case, and I apologize for that. It certainly was not.
He was at the front for 1 or 2 weeks shortly after he got in Afghanistan and then went to work in a clinic before the U.S. war started and was in medical work right up till his capture. After he was captured, while in prison, he was shot. Dr. Aziz was killed.
Your time is up now on your rebuttal. Unless my colleagues have further cases, questions, the case will be submitted.
Well, I urge the court, law and justice require that the writ be granted in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.